President Donald Trump is insulting and empowering Europe. Israel is defending Germany, and we've all forgotten about one of the worst genocides going on the planet right now. We're going to look at all this and more on today's Trumpet World.
The US's long-awaited national security strategy has been published, and it reveals the Trump White House's vision of America's future in the world. This includes a focus on Latin American relations and immigration, and it questions its future relationship with Europe. Let's take a closer look at this rather disturbing document.
And it makes the Western Hemisphere a focus for the United States, and that includes the migration piece, the idea that you have to secure the homeland from unregulated migration, that's a key national security issue, is truly a first for an American national security strategy in the modern era. And the fact that the Western Hemisphere plays so largely in this strategy. And then, of course, the European questions are particularly pernicious for European allies.
And we'll come to that. But just to finish on this notion of spheres of influence, the corollary to this is ours and that's yours is Russia, China. You do your thing over there, and we'll do our thing over here, but you stay out.
We just heard this strategy that brutally criticizes allies in Europe.
It is a reversion to a 19th century version of American foreign policy. Before America learned the two hard lessons of the 20th century, that actually America retreating onto itself serves neither its own interests or the interests of global security more generally.
Mm. Briefly, if you can, does Europe need to be afraid?
I think Europe needs to recognize that it can't rely on America in the same way that it has done for the last 80 years. Europe needs to actually recognize that this is a very different version of America, one that is not just the whims of Donald Trump, but actually is institutionalizing a different approach to the world. And it needs to take on board the strategic implications of that, that Europe needs to be more unified and more purposeful in thinking about its own security and its own interests, and cannot assume that the old world order is still present.
Point that people like Jürgen Hart rejected the most strongly when I spoke to them today. None of them were informed about the strategy. They all found out via the press, essentially. So that is already in itself a sign of just how tense the situation is, that the US doesn't appear to be contacting one of its closest ally, Germany, in these matters anymore. But of course, it also, now this document means that we've got in black and white, now from the US president himself, in writing, what members of this administration have been telling Europe for months now. Actually, since the administration got into power, J.D. Vance has said it.
Take note, for Israel and Saudi Arabia and others, the document says that America's reasons for focusing on the Middle East will recede. That's quite a change. And in an attempt to impose a MAGA agenda on Europe, the Trump administration warns Europe it must sharply reduce immigration or face, quote, civilizational erasure due to migration from non-European countries.
This is a retreat from the world, it seems to me. It's a smaller, weaker America. And Jim, I ask myself, why is it? Because somewhere in this document, it sort of indicates we can't afford it. But at the same time, the document is saying we're such a great, vibrant nation. We're so great. So why can't we afford this? Is it because we can't deal with our own fiscal responsibility? You know, I didn't find anything inconsistent with the actions of the administration, but seeing it in black and white and having it unravel like this, it's a big change. It's transformational. And it may pave the way.
U.S. President Donald Trump published his new national security strategy this week, and as you heard in that montage there, it did not go down very well. And you can understand, hostility is officially White House policy, declared the New York Times, commenting on it from Europe's perspective. And politicians all across Europe have been complaining about it. Friedrich Merz, the German Chancellor, said some of it is unacceptable for us from a European point of view. And he said, as a result, we in Europe and therefore also in Germany must become more independent of the United States in security policy. Norbert Röttingen, a foreign policy expert, very influential within the German government and the Christian Democratic Union, he said that this is a second turning point, similar to Russia's invasion of Ukraine, for motivating and leading to another boost in German military spending. And when you look at Donald Trump speaking in his own words about this national security strategy, it's pretty easy to see why European leaders feel insulted. Shortly afterwards, he gave an interview to Politico about it. And here's a sampling of what he said then.
You can imagine some leaders in Europe are a little freaked out by your posture is. And European...
No, they should be freaked out by what they're doing to their countries. They're destroying their countries.
Well, European
and
Council
and
President...
And the people I like. Look, they're people I like. I get along with them. You know that. But they can't let this happen. And it gets to a point where you can't really correct it. There'll be a point, and it's very close to that point.
And what will that mean?
It will mean that they're no longer going to be strong nations.
Does that mean they won't be allies?
Or they'll be, well, it depends, you know, it depends. They'll change their ideology, obviously, because the people coming in have a totally different ideology. But it's going to make them much weaker. They'll be much weaker, and they'll be much different.
And what will that mean for our relationship?
Look at your
them.
Mayor of London. He's a disaster. He's got a totally different ideology of what he's supposed to have. And he gets elected because so many people have come in and they vote for him now because, you know, it's like, it's one of those things. But I hate what's happened to London, and I hate what's happened to Paris. I hate when I see it.
You know, sir, it's sometimes hard to tell when you say these things, do you intend to send kind of a message of tough love to our allies to push them to make reforms? Or do you think that many of them are just weak and you don't really want to be allies with them?
I think they're weak. But I also think that they want to be so politically correct. They don't know what to do. Europe doesn't know what to do. They don't know what to do on trade either. I mean, I look at a lot of the trade, you know, situation that's going on over there. It's a little bit dangerous. But Europe, they want to be politically correct, and it makes them weak. That's what makes them weak.
It sounds like you want to see some pretty massive changes.
No nation wants to get that kind of smackdown from another national leader. But while he was angering and alienating Europe, President Trump also committed America to support a massive military and cultural transformation in Europe. His calls to promote European greatness and to commit America's foreign policy to promoting European greatness, those have been overlooked. Really, what President Trump was doing was encouraging Europe to become the revived Holy Roman Empire that Herbert W. Armstrong warned of decades ago. In that clip, basically told Europe that he doesn't want to be allies with them, at the same time as he committed to making Europe great again. So what exactly is in this document and where is it leading? Well, Europe faces civilizational erasure, according to the National Security Strategy. It says that the activities of the European Union and other transnational bodies that undermine political liberty and sovereignty, migration policies that are transforming the continent and creating strife, censorship of free speech and suppression of political opposition, cratering birth rates, and loss of national identity and self-confidence. You know, this is what's behind this civilizational erasure. And this is true. You know, all of these things are things that we talk about quite regularly on this show. The mass migration and how that is destroying Europe. How the European Union does lack huge amounts of political liberty. I mean, this almost the same time as this was going out, you saw Europe putting a massive fine on Twitter, the first fine ever under their new Digital Service Act. And they accused Twitter, or X as it is now, of deceiving users with blue check marks, obscuring information on ads, shutting out researchers. But it's not about a few technicalities and regulations. This is about the EU not liking the freest, most open, large social media platform out there. And they've spent a while looking for ways to crack down on it and put fines on it. The U.S. Secretary of State, Marco Rubio, he said that it is an attack on all American tech platforms and the American people by foreign governments. And he's right. And like I said, all of these other problems, they are real problems. It says, should present trends continue, the continent will be unrecognizable in 20 years or less. As such, it is far from obvious whether certain European countries will have economies and militaries strong enough to remain reliable allies. So Europe is attacking America, as Marco Rubio said. It's turning against American values. It's rapidly declining. But the response of the national security strategy here is to persuade it to rearm. It says, we want to work with aligned countries and want to restore their former greatness. It said that America should prioritize enabling Europe to stand on its own feet, including by taking primary responsibility for its own defense. And there have been other bits of communication alongside this national security strategy. One was the leaking of a supposedly much longer security strategy, talking about Donald Trump's desire to empower certain culturally right-wing parties and groups like the Alternative for Deutschland. Another was Pentagon officials talking to European officials over the weekend, saying that they want Europe to take over most of NATO's conventional defense capabilities by 2027. German defense spending has doubled since 2015. It's on course to double again by 2029. But this is a whole nother level of military power that President Trump is pushing Germany, really as Europe's largest military power by a long way now, to take on. The strategy document says the days of the United States propping up the entire world order like Atlas are over. And instead, it says U.S. allies should assume primary responsibility for their regions. Now, this document puts a lot of focus on Latin America and the Monroe Doctrine, something America does need to focus on. This is an area that America needs to make sure other countries don't move into, because then they can very directly threaten the United States. But the whole thrust was basically, we're only going to focus here on the Western Hemisphere, North and South America. We'll put a lot of focus there. What happens everywhere else? We don't really mind so much. And we would rather just outsource whatever's going on in Europe to Europe. And this is even the approach to Latin America is all part of this Make Europe Great Again strategy. And it's about, like I said, much more than a military revival. The strategy paper says America wants Europe to regain its civilizational self-confidence. It calls for America to encourage unapologetic celebration of European nations' individual character and history. It says America encourages its political allies in Europe to promote this revival of spirit, and the growing influence of patriotic European parties indeed gives cause for great optimism. But what spirit are they reviving here? And I mentioned that longer leaked strategy that talked about working with parties like the Alternative for Deutschland and a lot of these non-mainstream European parties. J.D. Vance, Marco Rubio, the former U.S. ambassador to Germany, Rick Grenell, Elon Musk, they've all openly campaigned for the Alternative for Deutschland. And the AfD also wants an unapologetic celebration of German history. And in 2017, their then leader, Alexander Gauland, said, if the French are rightly proud of their empire and the Britons of Nelson and Churchill, we have the right to be proud of the achievements of the German soldiers in two world wars. Yeah, we need to celebrate our history. He said the nation needs a 180-degree reversal on our politics of remembrance. And all around, you know, he was saying this, there was a big crowd shouting, Deutschland, Deutschland. Historical guilt should no longer determine the way we act, said the AfD's current leader, or one of their two current leaders. Now, those behind the strategy document may well say, no, no, not that history. Okay, celebrate Europe's history, but not Germany in World War II. I mean, that document points to Europe's culture, its art, its sophistication. It says Europe is home to cutting-edge scientific research and world-leading cultural institutions. And that's the history they talk really about wanting to revive. But what they don't understand is World War II was not an aberration from that history. Europe's history of art and culture and sophistication is also a history of war, persecution, and conquest. Its period of darkness, darkest depravity came at the same time as some of this greatest, most beautiful art and culture. It came when Europe was dominated by the Holy Roman Empire, this church-state union that brutally punished dissent. This mistake that President Trump and his team are making Mr. Gerald Flurry wrote about this at length in his book, Daniel Unlocks Revelation. And there he says, about the only thing Americans can seem to think of when it comes to Europe is somebody yodeling in the Alps. They have no idea what the Holy Roman Empire is about or what that crown is about. They don't know anything about this deadly beast. You can travel all over Central Europe and see some of the opulence of the Habsburgs. The Habsburgs were the sword of the Catholic Church throughout the Middle Ages. They did their killing while supporting artists like Mozart, Bach, and Schubert. They were very sophisticated as they slaughtered people. You've got to keep quotes like that in mind, points like that in mind when reading this national security strategy that says Europe is home to cutting-edge scientific research and world-leading cultural institutions. Yeah, this is that heritage that the Trump administration have said they want to revive. Charlemagne, the 8th, 9th century Frankish empire, emperor, he pioneered this connection between the Holy Roman Empire and the German peoples. And European leaders revere him as an ancestor of their own unification project. When former German president Roman Herzog was given the Charlemagne Prize in 1997, he said, Charlemagne, after whom our prize is named, made his own particular choice, the first unification of Europe. At such an hour, the truth must be told. Only by wading through a sea of blood, sweat, and tears did he reach his goal. It took a lot of blood to bring that culture that President Trump wants now to bring back. Now, Hitler was inspired by Charlemagne, by the crown jewels of Charlemagne, the crown jewels of the Holy Roman Empire. In Mein Kampf, he wrote, the imperial crown jewels kept in Vienna, reminders of the old realm's splendor, still seemed to exercise a magic spell, a pledge of eternal communion. And when he conquered Vienna, he took those crown jewels back to Nuremberg as a sign of the tangible connection between the Third Reich and the First Reich. And things like this censorship and some of the other things that President Trump highlighted, you know, they are signs of the spirit of the Holy Roman Empire rising again. Encouraging Europe to embrace this revival of spirit is not about creating a stable democratic American ally. It's reviving a spirit that is opposed to these pluralistic American values. And really, with what's happening with the national security strategy, Europe has pretty much no choice but to do what Donald Trump wants. He's really pushing them hard in that direction. This is what George Friedman had to say about it in a podcast that he gave shortly afterwards.
Europe is a group of small, weak countries with fragmented economies, with bad memories of each other, deep distrust. As that, it's going to be left out of the game. On the other hand, if Europe were to become a united entity, a nation, with the various nations' provinces, it could be a major power ranking with the US and China, having its own military and so on.
You know, this is the position. Europe has two paths forward. If they remain divided, they're just going to be utterly irrelevant in a world of China and Russia and the United States. If they come together, well, they're going to be a matching American power. And that's exactly what Mr. Armstrong said. That Europe is going to combine its forces. They are going to match its power. Exceed its power, even. And the document, it kind of assumes that if Europe makes this turnaround that President Trump is ultimately pushing them to make, a revival of a spirit, massive military spending. As Friedman talked about, the only way to really do that is to come together and unite. For them to do that, well, are they going to remain a loyal American ally? I mean, that's what President Trump assumes. The document says we will need a strong Europe to help us successfully compete and to work in concert with us to prevent any adversary from dominating Europe. The assumption there is that a strong Europe would never be an adversary. It would always be helping America against adversaries. Is that really what would happen? Well, Alice Vidal, the AfD's other co-leader, she answered that in an interview with the American Conservative earlier this year, When President Donald Trump demands that Germany must take responsibility for its own security in the future, he should also be clear about the full consequences, she said. You know, that we'll listen kindly to his concerns, and she went on to give the example of the Nord Stream pipeline that Donald Trump didn't like. And so when he comes to us with something like that that he doesn't like, well, yeah, we'll listen. But then we'll make our own decisions, and he must accept that whether he likes them or not. You know, if we're going to become dominant and powerful, don't be surprised when we go off and do our own thing. And I've made this point before, but it's so fascinating to me the way that a year ago or so now, just over a year ago, before President Trump won that election, the AfD was largely an anti-American party. And I think English speakers would be amazed at some of the discussions that were going on within the AfD. Compact, this magazine that was banned and then unbanned, but it's a magazine that's by and for AfD supporters. And it's got a really different and twisted and extreme view of the world. You look at some of their special issues. They've had a special issue of their history magazine on lost homeland, describing the, quote, unspeakable suffering of the 14 million Germans expelled from Eastern Europe after the war and the, quote, martyrdom they had to endure. And yet, the story of Germans pushed out of Eastern Europe after World War II is worth telling. But putting the slant on them that they're martyrs, that's quite a distortion of history. Crimes Against Germans was one about how Germany was victimized during World War II. Dresden, 1945, the dead, the perpetrators, and the trivializers. That's about the, quote, Anglo-American bombing terror and the, quote, mass murderer, Winston Churchill. The death camps of the Americans was an issue about General Dwight Eisenhower, accusing him of carrying out mass execution of German prisoners of war in 1945. Compact wrote in another article, the German soldiers fought mostly chivalrously and honorably in the Second World War. And it says that, you know, there were a small number of criminals, but offenses were usually severely punished by the military system. You know, we need to be proud of what our soldiers accomplished in World War II. That's what this party has said. And Donald Trump's administration is saying, yeah, oh, get back to patriotism and pride in your culture, Europe. All the way back in 1995, Mr. Flurry talked about this and some of Europe's history, some of Germany's history, and he wrote, and now America is acting as if none of this history has ever occurred. I can understand our leaders ignoring Bible prophecy, but how can you explain their ignoring history? No superpower can do this and survive. And Herbert W. Armstrong warned for years about exactly the power that we're seeing rise up. You know, we're seeing now these headlines, like The Atlantic, about Europe's military power, and The Telegraph, and all of these newspapers seeing what Europe is doing. We had another one this week. The Rise of German Nationalism Exposes Washington's Delusions. That was from the American Conservative. I mean, these are headlines that Mr. Armstrong could have written. He did have very similar statements. He said it's going to happen. It's happening. No, he said, Europeans want their own military power. They know a political union of Europe would produce a third major world power as strong as the United States or the USSR, possibly stronger. But he also talked about the way that America and Britain were helping to build this power. This is what he had to say in one of his radio broadcasts.
You know what we want to do? We want to put trust in men. We want to rely on men. What are we doing in our nation now? Well, we're trying to rely on Germany and Japan. We're hoping that they're going to be allies, and we're hoping we'll be able to control them. While we begin building up a Frankenstein, and you're going to be in fright and terror of it pretty soon. If you don't know God, that's your only protection, my friends, and you'd better heed it while you may. He saves you from the fowler's snare and from the deadly pit. He protects you from his pinions and hides you underneath his wings. You need not fear the terrors of the night, nor arrows flying by day, nor need you fear hydrogen bombs. But you need not fear the terrors of the night, nor arrows flying by the day. Well, it's speaking in terms of the kind of weapons they had when this was written way back there several centuries before Christ. But let's say you don't need to fear the fallout of atomic energy and all that sort of thing today. You don't need to fear anything that's coming if you really know God. But not very many of you do, my friends. A lot of you have been kidding yourselves. You think you know God. You're taking a lot for granted. Let him that thinketh he standeth take heed, lest he fall. So says your Bible, and God is the author of that Bible.
Just a very powerful, classic Mr. Armstrong clip, combining that prophetic warning along with, you know, the emphasis on looking at ourselves, making sure that we're responding to this warning. And he showed in his book, The United States and Britain in Prophecy, and proved from the Bible. I mean, this is really all about God and the Bible, not Herbert W. Armstrong. But he was writing in that book, The United States and Britain in Prophecy, he showed how Britain and America are the modern descendants of ancient Israel. And there's so many prophecies in the Bible that warn about Israel. You know, Britain, America, the Jews in the Middle East and others trusting in lovers, foreign allies, instead of trusting in God. Even as we heard a bit about in that clip from Mr. Armstrong. And God says that those allies, those lovers are going to turn against you. And now, that's exactly what Britain and America are doing. America, okay, we do have, America does have all of these massive expenses. America has carried a huge burden of holding up world peace. And you can understand why people, American taxpayers, are fed up of carrying that burden, largely unthanked and unsupported by everyone else. And so, well, we'll just focus on our Western Hemisphere and we'll hope Europe takes care of things, but it's not really our problem. And we'll just go home now. But that's putting the trust in this European power that Donald Trump wants to raise up instead of trusting in God. And really, the only national security document that America needs would declare God as America's protector and sure defense. It would urge the nation to humble repentance and obedience to God's law to secure that protection. And yeah, I know that document would produce even more howls of outrage and screams of criticism than this one has, because we are very, very far away from that. To a lot of people, to a lot of even Christians, a document like that would be utterly preposterous. And that's why God is raising up this power in Europe. A lot has to change before we would countenance anything like that. But that's the lesson we have to learn. That's the lesson Mr. Armstrong talks about in our free book, The United States and Britain in Prophecy. And that's, you know, if you want to know more about this, if you want to know more about what the Bible prophecy says for the world and world events, I'd really encourage you to order that book. We'll send it to you for free. You can read it online for free. And it shows what God is doing in the world. It shows why God is doing it. And you can get that on our website, thetrumpet.com. But there's one more important story I wanted to talk about briefly, and an important part really of this same story, where George Friedman, when he was talking about, well, Donald Trump here, he's really forcing Europe to unite and to come together, he also expressed a lot of skepticism as to whether Europe could come together. Completely understandably so. He points out that you have had centuries of history of European nations fighting each other. And they've had decades of trying to come together in the European Union, where lots of different leaders have wanted to have a United States of Europe, and they've not managed to do it. And so he said, well, Europe, really, they've got two paths forward. One is they go their separate way and they just become increasingly irrelevant to the modern world. And two is they unify and they become this massive power. And he says, well, both are possible, but I tend to think they're going to go their own separate ways and be a bit irrelevant because they haven't managed to come together. And Mr. Armstrong talked about this too. And he talked about the way all of these leaders will talk and they can't get together by themselves. They keep failing. And he said, yeah, that's going to keep happening until the Vatican gets involved, the Catholic Church gets involved. That is the only force that can provide the common glue, the common heritage to bring all of Europe together. And in that context, he talked about the Catholic Church gathering in its Protestant daughters and gathering in its Orthodox daughters. You're having this unification and that giving the Catholic Church extra clout and power to then say, well, yeah, we'll help unify all of Europe as well. And right now we're seeing the Pope, you know, going to Nicaea, like we've talked about on previous shows, and talking about unification and drawing closer to the Orthodox communion. So also this week, the Pope met with representatives from the European Conservative and Reformist Group. This is the group that many European right-wing parties sit in when they sit in the European Parliament. And in some ways, his call was pretty similar to Donald Trump. He reminded people, he said, well, we have to call to mind some of the important developments in Western civilization, especially the cultural treasures of its towering cathedrals, sublime art and music, and advances in science, not to mention the growth and spread of the universities. These developments create an intrinsic link between Christianity and European history, a history which should be cherished and celebrated. And just like we were saying, though, what he omits is that at the same time you did have some of that history, you had people being tortured in the basement. And you had some of this repression going on side by side. Now, when he was talking about Nicaea and he was sending out his earlier letter, he praised Emperor Constantine and the Council of Nicaea as a model of how to bring unity to Christians. And he glossed over the fact that this was accomplished by state-sanctioned persecution by the Catholic Church. He kind of continued the same approach in his meeting this week, where he encouraged the lawmakers to emulate Saint Thomas More. And Thomas More was no saint. The Catholic Church may have made him one. That doesn't make him a good person. Thomas More burned those he disagreed with at the stake. I think he burnt the first person in London, at least for a long, long time. But he really kind of popularized or established burning at the stake as the way to deal with the Protestant Reformation in England. Now, he was sincere in his beliefs. He chose to be martyred himself rather than go along with King Henry VIII's break from Rome. But you know, this was a person who was very much for and a part of political oppression, destroying those that you disagree with. And so once again, you have a message from the Pope that looks nice on the surface, but you look just below that and you realize, you know, he's praising political and religious leaders who built these so-called cultural treasures, as the Pope said, but enforce religious dogmas using the power of the state. I mean, this is what the Bible talks about as this church that looks like a lamb and speaks like the dragon. That's where Europe is going to turn. They're going to heed that call to revive their roots and go back to their roots. So keep watching for that story as well. And we've been talking about America empowering Europe and Europe betraying America. Another important component to this is Judah and the little nation of Israel in the Middle East. Also turning to Germany, empowering Germany, and that is going to backfire horribly on them as well. And this week we saw an important development there where Friedrich Merz finally made his first trip to Israel. So we'll hear more about that from our Middle East correspondent, Mihailo Zekic.
Yes, as you mentioned, German Chancellor Friedrich Merz visited Israel on December 6th and 7th, his first visit since becoming chancellor. This comes on the heels of Israel giving its Arrow 3 missile system to Germany last week. That's the largest defense export in Israel's history, worth over $4.5 billion. It's Israel's primary defense against intercontinental ballistic missile type attacks. They use them against the Houthis, which was the first missile intercepted in space, if I remember correctly, in history. It's the kind of thing that you would use to defend yourself against Russian missiles and a lot of these more heavier militaries going against you. So you're essentially having Israel arm Germany against Russia. And again, this is the context of Merz's visit. No other country has a similar umbrella like this. This is the first time Israel's given a system to a country like Germany. And then on December 7th, he had a press conference with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, where they touched up on this new deal and what it means for Israeli-German relations.
These and other statements are very important because they reflect a deeper commitment which expresses the intertwined destinies of Israel and Germany. We went through the greatest tragedy that any people suffered on German soil and committed by Germans. And the generations that followed the Holocaust were understood that there was a special moral commitment to enable the Jewish state, the Jewish people, to recover from this horror. And Germany was committed and remains committed to Israel's security in many important ways. What has happened since the rise of the Jewish state is that we have been able to fend off our enemies. And in order to do that, we developed capacities that now enable us to reciprocate. Not only does Germany work in the defense of Israel, but Israel, the Jewish state, 80 years after the Holocaust, works for the defense of Germany.
Mr. Netanyahu was not the only Israeli politician to express this kind of amazement. Ron Prosser, Israel's ambassador to Germany, had similar comments about this, and so did other people in Israel's establishment. You could see that they're really, I don't want to say stunned, but they're still taken aback by this moment where the Holocaust is still within living memory, and now Israel is providing Germany with the ability to defend itself against those adversaries that you were mentioning earlier. That wasn't the only thing they discussed. Merz took the time to talk about how Germany supports a Palestinian state. Netanyahu rebuffed him mildly in his comments, but at the same time, his rebuttal was, we were allowed to disagree. That's what friends do. We can have hard conversations with each other. That still means we're friends. You don't see him saying that to the French or the British or any of these other countries that are going out of their way to support a two-state solution from him or from anybody else in Israel. Instead, when Germany says that we still support a two-state solution, we want something done with the Palestinians, Netanyahu says, I could disagree with you about that, but I still consider you a close associate. And I'm still going to keep you close.
Yeah, and this Arrow missile system, I mean, it's easy to get kind of caught up because we're always seeing headlines about, well, this country agreed to buy this missile or this system or this thing from this other country. And for me, I'd let that kind of get a bit buried in all of the noise around there. But this is a very, very significant part of Germany's defense. I mean, like you were saying, this is kind of the only thing that Germany has that could shoot down an incoming Russian intercontinental ballistic missile. I mean, I think the Arrow 3 would be insufficient to defend against a full-on Russian assault like that. But that gives you a sense of this is a very significant relationship between the two, even more so than just, hey, we're selling some bullets or some shells to Germany.
Very much. As I mentioned earlier, this has already been tested. A lot of these systems against these kinds of attacks, they're good in theory, but nobody's ever tried to use them because using them would mean world war. But Israel, in smaller scales, like with the Houthis, has already tested, saying, we have a product that you could already rely on. It's been proven on the battlefield. And again, this is for basically nuclear war preparation. You have basically Israel and Germany making deals with themselves with nuclear war in mind, and with the idea that those two are going to be allies with each other using the same systems, the same integrated components, if that were to happen. And that, again, shows how much Israel trusts Germany. This is the system that Israel itself uses. This is not something that they're producing lower grade material, as you were saying, that if relations were to sour between the two countries, they wouldn't have to worry about those weapons being used against them. This is Israel exposing some of its most fundamental security systems, how they work, how they can fail, how to disable them if you want, to another country. You don't do that to countries you expect to be able to disable your own systems down the road. There's a reason Israel hasn't been sending this system to other countries. I'm sure they can make a lot of money if they did so, but doing so would compromise their own security, and they feel that Germany would not do that.
And so here we have another example of that same prophecy that we just talked about. This time it's Judah turning to an empowering Germany. And the prophecies for Israel and Judah are the same here, that they would both turn to, they would both empower Germany, and both would bitterly regret that.
Yes, and I think this is interesting that this is happening at the same time as Israel, the state of Israel, is having problems with the United States. Mr. Netanyahu is not allowed to say that in front of the cameras, but between all these pressures for a ceasefire, between all this pressure from President Trump to let Hamas live, to not go after Syria, to do all these things, you're starting to see Germany become amazingly even more close of an ally to Israel, at least on paper, than the United States is. Israel, it has a lot of things going for it technologically, but manufacturing-wise, it can't depend on itself to fight its own wars. It needs physically another country to attach to get the weapons to fight its wars. And if the United States isn't going to be that country, then Germany, as far as Israel's leaders are concerned, seems like the next best option. The prophecy that came to my mind when I was looking at this was in Ezekiel 23, which speaks of, like as you were mentioning, Israel and Judah turning to the Assyrians as lovers. And that prophecy speaks of Israel and Judah under prophetic language. Judah is called Aholibah, a female name, and it says in verse 12, quote, she doted upon the Assyrians, her neighbors, captains and rulers clothed most gorgeously, horsemen riding upon horsemen, all of them desirable young men. So even the context is military. Look how strong they are militarily. Look at what they do. We need this. We need to be integrated into this as much as possible. And as you mentioned, and as the prophecy in that just that chapter brings out, well, God wants to be the one that Israel and Judah trust in. God anciently was married to them. That's what the Old Covenant was about. He referred to that several times throughout the Old Testament passages. And even though the relationship isn't the same today, God still has a history with his people. God still wants to have a history with these people. And Israel, the state of Israel in this case, is trusting in these foreign nations and these foreign military powers the way God would expect her to trust to her husband. So an adulterous affair is an apt example. And God prophesies that this is not going to end well. Verse 22 of Ezekiel 23 says, therefore, O Aholibah, thus says the Lord God, behold, I will raise up your lovers against them, from whom your mind is alienated, and I will bring them against you on every side. So you mentioned how the law of history should get us to reconsider, wait a minute, what's going on here? Israel is, while the Holocaust is still within living memory, trusting the country that perpetrated the Holocaust. That's obviously important, but the main factor here is that God is letting all this happen. In Revelation 17, a companion passage, God says that he puts it in their minds, in this beast power's mind, to fulfill his will. This is not just putting the chess pieces together on a geopolitical board, figuring out what everybody's likely to do, what everybody wants to do. God is letting all these events happen for a purpose and as a response to his people's sins. Now, if people would like to learn more about the context of this Arrow 3 deal and Merz's visit, etc., our Germany correspondent Josue Michels wrote an article this week called Israel Arms Germany that was on the Trumpet website that they could learn more about it that way.
Well, thank you very much for that, Mihailo. Shifting gears now away from Europe, we got a bit of a reminder this week about a critical story that has been around now for quite a few years, but has drifted off a lot of people's radar. To get an update on that, we'll turn to our Asia correspondent, Jeremiah Jacques.
Yes, that's right, Mr. Palmer. The big story that I wanted to discuss is that the Uyghur people of northwestern China are still suffering horrendously at the hand of the Chinese Communist Party, even though the world has, as you said, basically stopped talking about this. So the Uyghurs, they are a Turkic-speaking people living in Xinjiang. That's a part of the world that the Uyghurs would like to be their own country, but that the Chinese colonized some years ago. And the Chinese have been working to eradicate religion from the thinking of these Uyghurs so that they'll be good subjects, easy to rule. And the attempts to do that have led to one of the most oppressive and brutal crackdowns in history. The Chinese have had maybe as many as 3 million of the Uyghurs in concentration camps. And in these camps, they are beaten and starved and forcibly medicated and just subjected to all kinds of cruelty and abuse in an effort to turn them into people who worship only the Chinese state and who don't let religion influence them very much. So the abuses in these camps are as extreme as anything you can imagine, and they are just very shocking, but they're well documented. And back in 2021, the first Trump administration examined all of these abuses and determined that what the Chinese are doing was no less than genocide. So the Trump administration put that label on what the Chinese were doing with an official designation, and as a result, a whole host of nations sanctioned a lot of the goods that China was producing with the Uyghurs' forced labor. And media outlets and human rights activists would routinely spotlight the suffering of the Uyghur people. But today, the situation is different. The Chinese government's genocide of the Uyghurs is now very seldom discussed. There was an analysis published a few days ago by G0 Media, and it found that only 0.03% of English language news articles are now about the Uyghurs. So just a tiny fraction. And this is due to three main factors. First, you've got China spending big bucks to really reframe global perception of what's happening in Xinjiang. The Chinese have flown in several influencers and journalists from various nations, and they give these people kind of a Potemkin village tour of Xinjiang. And by that tactic, China has kind of airbrushed the picture, and they've created a far softer version of what they're actually doing. So that has taken some of the pressure off. And then the Chinese have also just used their economic heft to discourage trade partners from speaking out about the genocide. Then the second reason why very few are talking about the Uyghur genocide is because the second Trump administration is far less concerned about human rights than the first one was. You know, it was Secretary of State Mike Pompeo who declared this abuse a genocide, who really led that campaign during Trump's first administration. And the facts showed that that designation was well justified. But Trump 2.0 has a whole different cast of characters, a starkly different cabinet, and men like Mike Pompeo are in short supply. So with Trump 2.0, there has been just a deliberate de-emphasizing of human rights, and that has played a big role, I think, in this deafening silence that we're hearing about the Uyghurs. And then the last factor is just that there is a finite supply of atrocity attention in the world. You know, there are only so many things that people can be outraged by at a given time. And in recent years, crises committed by the Russians and Islamists and others have drawn more of the focus, especially since many of those atrocities are more accessible than what we see in this remote and tightly controlled part of China. So this has all added up to erase, you know, what we've been seeing in the headlines or what we had previously been seeing. But that doesn't mean that the suffering has ended. There are still unspeakable horrors happening at the hands of the Chinese Communist Party, really just beyond comprehension. And it's something the world should not memory hole and that we should not forget about. And we have a very powerful article in our archives. It's by Trumpet Editor-in-Chief Gerald Fleury. It's called The Climax of Man's Rule Over Man. And this article is built around biblical prophecies saying that the world will descend into an era called the Times of the Gentiles. In the modern age, Mr. Fleury discusses the way American leadership and British leadership, for years, it was overall a positive force in the world. You know, it brought a great deal of stability and opportunity to billions of people. Those countries had biblically influenced beliefs in the God-given rights of individuals and in the rule of law. So they did bring a lot of stability to many peoples and nations around the world. But that era is now ending, and the times of the Gentiles has begun. And in this new era, ruthless governments like the one that we see in China, are growing more and more powerful and more determined to extend and expand their power. Mr. Fleury actually specifically mentions Xinjiang, China, in this article, and he says that atrocities like those happening there are an indication of just how dark the times of the Gentiles will be. So that kind of barbarity will soon be happening at a global scale. So it's a very powerful article, and once again it is called The Climax of Man's Rule Over Man.
Great. Thank you very much for that report, Jeremiah. Just before we move on, I'm curious, do you think things, as, say, the Xinjiang crackdown has become higher and higher tech and moved more into surveillance and maybe been less brute force, are there fewer people in concentration camps now? Is it less brutal now, but maybe more kind of sophisticated and dystopian? Or is it just simply that China is getting better at marketing it and trying to put on a face of it's not too bad on the whole thing?
It's a very good question. And I think that there probably is a lot more sort of preemptive, you know, monitoring going on so that they can arrest those who they view as potentially disruptive and kind of quietly deal with them rather than having to wait until some of the types of what the Chinese labeled terrorist attacks were occurring 15, 20 years ago. And it is true that Xinjiang has one of the highest concentrations of cameras in the world. There's nowhere you can be, as far as I understand, in that region where you're not under the watchful gaze of probably several lenses at a time. So I think that's a fair point, that some of this might be almost preemptive deterrence away from some of the radicalism among the Uyghurs that apparently there was several years ago. And maybe it is a changing dynamic in light of that technology. But because the Chinese keep it so tightly, you know, sealed off and so well controlled, it's difficult to know with certainty what exactly the situation is there at a given time.
Well, thank you for making sure that we're still keeping track of that critical story. What else did you have for us from Asia this week?
Yes, first up, a quick story. China has published a new policy paper outlining its plans to enhance cooperation in more than 40 areas with a range of Latin American countries. So the Chinese, they'll be spending more to develop these Latin American and Caribbean nations and to work more closely with them. And this will translate into more Chinese influence over these countries, many of which sit astride some of the most important trade routes for United States shipping. So, you know, China is strengthening ties to Latin American and Caribbean nations. It's a trend that's been underway for years now, but it is accelerating. And it's leading to a time when China will be able to take all of the influence that they're building in this critical region, and they and their partners will be able to use it against the United States in some significant ways. And then the last story that I wanted to mention is about Thailand and Cambodia. These two nations had quite a significant border clash back in July, but President Trump and others were able to broker a peace deal between them. So the hostilities mostly ended at that time, but that peace deal, it never really addressed the root causes of their dispute. And now, a few months on, this conflict seems to have exploded again. There were new clashes this week with reports of small arms being used and artillery and even airstrikes and heavy weapons exchanges as well. So hundreds of thousands of civilians have been displaced, and it looks like the efforts to broker a peace deal there are proving even more elusive this time around. So it's yet another hotspot that seems to evade quick solution, and it'll be an important place for us to keep on watching in the days ahead.
Well, thank you for that, Jeremiah. Well, it feels like we've been talking about the United States almost the whole show, starting out with the national security strategy. We heard a bit about Donald Trump's attempt to bring peace, the Trump administration's approach to the genocide of Uyghurs in China. Now, though, we'll go to Andrew Miller and we'll get directly into the Anglo-America section. What is the big news that we haven't already covered so far, Mr. Miller?
Well, yeah, that's right. Definitely a lot of big news involving the United States in particular this week and foreign policy deals around the world. Focusing a little closer to home on a story that probably won't get much attention, although I wanted to highlight just due to some focus I've put on it over the past couple years, is the AI revolution. Artificial intelligence, it's revolutionizing society in many ways, and stands, one of the biggest applications of it is military. Donald Trump's Secretary of War, Pete Hegseth, definitely believes that. He put a post on social media this week saying, "The future of American warfare is here," and it's spelled AI. That post was particularly in regards to a fairly big decision the U.S. military announced this week to start incorporating more AI platforms into military applications. In particular, partnering with Google Gemini and using this Google-developed technology for deep research, formatting, all sorts of just different applications that military employees will now have downloaded on their computers that they can use. And so I'm sure we'll be getting a lot more information in the months and years to come on just the far-reaching applications that artificial intelligence will likely have on how the U.S. military operates. One thing, though, that when I read this Axios headline, the Axios headline is U.S. military to use Google Gemini in new AI platforms, my initial response was one of concern because for the past couple years, especially as I've been writing about the Twitter files that Elon Musk has put out and different attempts by Joe Biden and Barack Obama's FBI to influence the results of elections here in America, Google has popped up repeatedly as the bad guy. There's a pretty famous computer scientist here, Robert Epstein, no relation to the more famous Jeffrey Epstein, but Robert Epstein, who in his estimation, he thought that several million votes were shifted from Donald Trump to Joe Biden just due to biased Google algorithms. So that's not overt election theft. That's not stealing votes. That's saying that people who would otherwise have not voted for Joe Biden did vote for him because when they've got political questions and they go to Google and they type something into the chat bar, the algorithm was specifically designed to promote liberalism and suppress conservatism. I wrote an article a couple years back titled "The Biggest Threat to American Democracy," which was actually about just the manipulation of the online world. And there's I'll see if I've got this quote here. Yeah, I brought that article with me. There's one quote. Zachary Vorez was a Google employee who did the closest thing we've had to the Twitter files for Google. Elon Musk is not rich enough to buy Google, so we haven't gotten a deep enough look into Google as we had Twitter. But he did release 950 pages of like proprietary Google papers on the shadow banning. And when he was trying to explain his decision, he said, "The reason I collected these documents was because I saw something dark and nefarious going on with the company that I realized they were not only going to tamper with elections, but use that tampering with elections to essentially overthrow the United States." And what he means by overthrow the United States is so that make it so that America is no longer a constitutional republic ruled by the people, But there's kind of like this technocracy ruled by big tech companies who control what you see and hear. And so Google has never actually been held account to for that action. Project Veritas has gotten a couple high-ranking Google employees on film basically admitting that they were trying to keep Donald Trump out of office. But you're seeing that just like the character of the company, that if this is the type of things they're doing with their machine learning technology, and now the military, U.S. military, which doesn't actually have an AI algorithm of its own, so it's outsourcing this important aspect of national defense to Google, is a strategic threat to the United States. And another article I was going to point people's attention to was one written by our editor-in-chief, Mr. Gerald Flurry, back just last year, March 2024. It's titled, "The Unknown Future of Artificial Intelligence." And in the introduction to that chapter, he said, There are a few things in the world as dark or hard to understand as the technologies involved in artificial intelligence. But Daniel 8 prophesies an end-time leader who will understand dark sentences. I believe God is now revealing what these dark sentences are about. Manipulating artificial intelligence is a powerful way to manipulate the minds of the masses. It also opens new possibilities in advanced warfare. Whoever understands this technology has a significant advantage in the world. And I think that is why Secretary of War Pete Hegseth is trying to incorporate more Google Gemini into U.S. defense applications. Because like Mr. Flurry said, these applications do give you a significant advantage in warfare, a significant advantage in the world. But the company developing them was recently exposed for trying to overturn the last couple presidential elections by making sure that people never found out about the Hunter Biden laptop. You put it into Google, it's not on your first page search results, or wasn't at the time. So even though it gives you a significant advantage, it also poses a significant threat. And then he's pointing here, too, to this verse in Daniel that says dark sentences. And that Hebrew word for dark sentences, it actually just means riddles or ciphers, something that's dark or obscure to understand. And then Mr. Flurry pointing to a prophesied leader to come, a European leader, prophesied in Daniel 8, who's just really good at understanding these type of dark sentences. And so now we're getting into a little bit of speculation since this is a new technology, but you have a European leader who understands dark sentences, according to Mr. Flurry's article here, that is a strong indication that he's going to be very proficient with artificial intelligence. Now the U.S. military is combining technologies with Google, a company that has historically not been very pro-democratic in its way to manipulate the minds of the masses. And it does give you a strategic vulnerability to the United States. And in other articles, Mr. Flurry's likened over-reliance on technology as the U.S. military's Achilles heel, the best way to bring it down. And he wrote that back in 1994, just when we were starting to just implement more computers into our defense technology. Artificial intelligence was something that was still just in the science fiction books. So I really think this is a story that just bears close watching to see exactly how Google and the U.S. defense industry start helping each other out, because it does represent really what is America's Achilles, what the American military's Achilles heel. And there's definitely some Bible prophecies about a European leader who understands dark sentences, likely including artificial intelligence algorithms that could enable him to exploit that Achilles heel to its fullest potential.
Well, it really does end up tying into a lot of what we were talking about earlier in the show. It's also, I think, an appropriate subject to be talking about as time has made AI the person of the year, or rather the architects of AI as the time person of the year. So certainly something that's been having a more and more dramatic impact, even just in terms of high RAM prices and hard drive prices and flash storage going up ridiculously in price. But there's much more deeper impacts that it's having on society, on the military now, that even are not immediately obvious. So thank you for bringing that to us, Andrew. Any other stories from the Anglo-America region?
Yeah, I'll do a few other ones. One story that is that if you're one of the many Americans who's kind of upset about the high price of housing at the moment, we have a new report released from data from the Department of Housing and Urban Development conclusively showing that the millions of illegal immigrants that Joe Biden let into America have indeed driven housing prices up, especially for the lowest income Americans. These millions of illegal immigrants coming here with no place to stay have needed to look for apartments or rentals or houses. And since they didn't have much money, they had to look for the cheapest apartment and rentals and houses and just basic supply and demand. If the demand for low-income housing goes up, the supply of low-income housing goes down and the price of low-income housing goes up. This this new report actually estimates that, let me get the exact statistic here. There are fewer than 60 affordable housing units available per 100,000 Americans considered low income. No, per 100 Americans. So for all the Americans considered low income, for every 100 Americans in the low income bracket, there's 60 houses they could afford, which means that the first 60 of them get those units, and then the other 40 of them are just really in a tight spot as they're forced to get a roommate or look for a housing unit that's really outside of their budget. And this is this one highlight of just kind of like what an economic curse on Americans it would be is just letting in 10 million unvetted immigrants. Another story, again related to Latin America, is the standoff between President Donald Trump and Venezuelan dictator Nicolas Maduro is heating up, with the U.S. seizing a huge Venezuelan oil tanker bound for Cuba this week. The Venezuelans, oil's the most important aspect of their economy. It represents 90% of their exports and 25% of their total gross domestic product. Right now, in an effort to bring about regime change in Venezuela and get the dictator Nicolas Maduro out of office, Donald Trump has put strict sanctions on Venezuela in an attempt to use economic pressure to try to get Maduro to resign and flee the country. Venezuela is trying to circumvent these sanctions by sending oil to their close communist ally in Cuba and then having the Cubans sell it on the black market for them. So the United States seizing this oil tanker is basically the new sign that Donald Trump's cracking down on that black market activity, trying to cut off their one lifeline to Cuba. Until the economic pressure gets great enough that they can get Nicolas Maduro out of office and someone who's more friendly to the West into office. And then the last story here, I guess kind of a sad one, ending on a bad note, is that an only guide report that covers the first 11 months of the year found that American citizens are spending $2.6 billion on the site's OnlyFans each year. This new report reveals that America is its biggest customer. I think it found specifically that Atlanta, Georgia was the city with the biggest OnlyFans users. So here you've got a British company that's being used by Americans more than anyone else, really promoting pornography and family breakdown. That's one of the primary sins and curses that's prompting God to punish America by letting a president like Joe Biden open up the border and drive up the housing prices, and a leader in Europe who understands dark sentences to come in and exploit the military's Achilles heel. So all of these political curses we've been talking about for the rest of this program, really getting back to God's correction for the sins of America, of which the OnlyFans app is one of the primary examples of.
Yeah, that's a great way to conclude the show. That is where the reason why we're getting so many of these. And I think from memory, I think the founders are kind of Russian, but it's listed on the in Britain. And I mean, some of the statistics about how widespread it's used and people spending money is just insane. And it's not a victimless crime. I mean, it's not a crime at all, I guess, sadly, but this destroys families. And a lot of this, it destroys families before they even start, in destroying the character of young men, and such widespread damage from this. And that's why we're getting these other curses. And once again, I'll just mention our free book, The United States and Britain in Prophecy, that explains what God is doing about this. And yes, the punishment that's coming on Britain and America as nations that had a relationship with God in the past and are now leading the world into sin. But then the redemption that's coming for Britain and America and the world, the education, the teaching about God's law and God's way of life that leads to happiness and joy, and the prosperity that's coming for the whole world as well. So that book is a great place to go to begin to understand Bible prophecy, and you can read that for free on our website, thetrumpet.com. Well, thank you so much, Andrew, and for everyone else that's been involved in the show. Thank you to Matthew Friesen, George Haddad, and Jacob Hessong for engineering and production. If you want to get in touch with us, please do send us an email, trumpetworld@thetrumpet.com. We'd be very happy to hear from you. We will be back with our regular shows next week. Until then, keep watching your world.